This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. On today's show, there's been a lot of discussion about cannabis grows on the Central Coast recently, especially when it comes to the odor of the plants. One Central Coast County Supervisor dives into this issue.
So there's very high stakes for getting odor control right, and these guys are going to have to get odor control right, but we have to finish the permitting process to do that.
And speaking of agriculture, it's berry season on the Central Coast, and it's not just people that love to pick them. So do birds.
They'll pick a berry, they'll come up to the bottom of the post where there's a little hole, and then another starling will get on top on the outside of the netting, and they will hand off the blueberries.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 1st, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. We begin today's show diving into a recent article in the Los Angeles Times that shed light on how, allegedly, Santa Barbara County supervisors allowed cannabis farms to grow, both in number and acreage, with virtually no regulation. According to the article by Joe Mazingo, this resulted in a litany of complaints by neighbors about odors and pest control disputes with avocado farmers. The story also took aim at Supervisor Doss Williams and what appears to be an especially close personal relationship with cannabis lobbyists. Rumors were reported that Williams may see a Democratic challenger next year, one that could be bankrolled by wealthy Democratic donors. To respond to the article and hear more about the future of cannabis in the county, KCRW's host of the podcast, The 805, Jonathan Bastian, recently sat down with Williams.
Okay, let's jump into this a little bit. The article says that Santa Barbara County holds 35% of all cultivation licenses issued in the state, despite the county having only 1.8% of the state's land. And the idea here is that supervisors made growers sign a fairly simple document or affidavit that certified that they had already been growing medical cannabis in the county, and as a result, that they could now grow commercial cannabis. So it essentially grandfathered them into the new system. But as we learned, a lot of newer growers frankly lied about this on their affidavits. They had not been previously growing in the county. As a result, it seems that we have a lot more grow operations than were originally intended. So how would you respond to the criticism that the supervisors really did not create an organized or regulated system to permit growers?
Sure. First of all, I don't think that the county did everything perfectly. This is a real tough public policy arena. People have been trying to get marijuana policy right for 100 years, and they've been failing for 100 years. So I don't believe that we're going to get things 100% right. But I think what those stats really, number one, they're outdated. You can look at the more recent information. But it ignores the difference. Those are just the people seeking legal permits. When I spoke to Humboldt County's planning director, he thought it was laughable that people compare us to Humboldt County. He says he's got 15,000 operations, marijuana operations in Humboldt County, and only 1,200 are seeking permits. So the scale is huge there, and his problem is he can't convince enough people to actually try the legal route. Here, there's some advantage that we have a bunch of people trying the legal route. It means we may be able to defeat the black market, which I view as a huge vector for human pain. And so I think that's the bigger picture, is that if you open the door too much, then obviously that will create nuisance. If you open the door not enough, then you're basically helping the black market to survive. And we're trying to achieve the right kind of balance here. The decision that the board made before I was on it to grandfather existing operations in their previous ban, I do think that was a mistake, because there really wasn't a good way to tell what were previously growing medicinal marijuana operations. However, very incorrect to say that we're not holding people accountable for lying on their affidavits. We've raided, since August, 35 of these grows. There's not even 35 grows in Carpinteria. So that's a countywide number, 35 grows. We've seized over 800,000 plants. thousands of pounds of finished product of marijuana. We are definitely holding people accountable for lying. Are we catching every single one? No, but we're definitely catching the worst.
To kind of continue with, I think, some of the points that came out here, the article also suggested that you had a particularly close or cozy relationship with some of the growers. They point to the fact that in fall of 2017, a man called Jared Ficker, who was lobbying hard to let growers on the registry cultivate with no limits, that he somehow ended up on one of your calendars, September 4th, for a sailing and a diving trip. Do you want to say more about that or kind of clarify the record?
Sure. I mean, it ended up being sailing for an hour or two. But if other people in the community want to go diving with me or surfing with me or sailing with me, I'm open. There's not a big barrier to meet with me as a supervisor. I represent everybody, and I got to meet with everybody. And sure, I'd rather sometimes meet with people over coffee or other things to learn more about issues. And if this reporter had bothered to, first of all, we gave him all the information. If he had bothered to ask about all the meetings I did with people on the other side, those that are critical to marijuana, he would have found that I met more often with people who were against marijuana or worried about marijuana. And I got just as many ideas from them for the formation of the ordinance. And that's why Carpinteria has a cap on acreage. That's why Carpinteria, we do not in the Carpinteria area allow outdoor grows or hoop house grows. And why odor control is mandatory, because in Carpinteria, the critics made the case to me that, look, we're all too close together, so we've got to have some special protections. That all ended up in the ordinance. And that's why, if you ask just about anybody, even some of the folks who are very intense on the other side, if odor is substantially approved since last year, they're going to say yes. Our ordinance did not go into effect in the coastal zone until last November. And so I ask you to judge me on how much things have improved since that time, and they've improved a lot.
I want to get to the odor questions in a minute, but to kind of just return to this question, and I take your point that no doubt you were meeting with the opposition to cannabis, but at least from the outsider's perspective, the idea of doing something on an intimate level like sailing or diving while perhaps you're crafting legislation and you're spending that kind of time with somebody who has a vested interest in making money off this, doesn't it just seem a little off?
Well, the way that county ordinance process takes is years. We're a town of only 14,000 people out in Carpinteria. If I'm supposed to avoid everybody in Carpinteria that has an interest either for or against marijuana, then I would be a hermit. I wouldn't be hanging out with anybody in my own community. You go to any event, there's going to be people who have an interest for and against. And I have very long-standing friendships and relationships that look just the same on some of the folks who are against marijuana. So, I mean, I'm a local guy. I grew up locally. I'm part of the community. It's a small community. Look, I'm going to hang out with people. I'm not going to like deep six friendships for years because there's a ordinance being formed on the board.
So you would just categorically deny that these are people that could conceivably help you or fund you moving forward and that you would have in any way been influenced by your relationships with them?
I've represented the local community for over 16 years now. And I just don't, I know that there's always people jockeying to get a piece of you and to try to convince you that what they're offering is the best thing since sliced bread. And you get very good at trying to figure out what they're telling you that's good policy and maybe sift out some of the things that aren't. And I'll tell you, the protections that we put in the ordinance for Carpinteria Valley, these were not all supported by the industry. We've had to say no to the marijuana industry on a lot of moves, including they're worried about this cap, right? and wanted us to change the cap to make it bigger. We're not going to do that. We've got to try to get the situation under control in Carpinteria, and we're not quite there yet, but it's a lot better than it was.
I mean, speaking of Carpinteria, I happen to live there as well, so part of the community with you, and while I know there have been efforts made to regulate tightly what's going on there, I mean, we also know that there are grow houses pretty darn close to the high school. And it seems to me that that's where the odor, as I drive Foothill Road all the time, it seems to be fairly concentrated in that area. I mean, aren't you concerned that maybe there should have been more preventative measures that went into place before there were grow houses there?
Well, I'm more concerned that the school district doesn't have enough money and is talking about laying off instructional aides and libraries and closing their library and things like that, that I think are going to affect these kids a lot more. And so is the rising property tax in the greenhouses going to help those schools? You better believe it. So I think it's not so simple. And we shut down one of the operations that was close to the high school. We raided them. We think it was a significant source of the odor. The odor is better. There's still some odor by the high school. I by the way, I drive by these places all the time, and I do these little tours, odor tours all the time. The stuff by the high school, I think, is a lot better. I live only 3.5 blocks from the one of the two places that's next to the high school. And I don't smell anything but once on a blue moon. I would say that we're having some other issues more on the east side of Foothill. But I've been trying to dig in deep and put pressure on those growers to improve their odor control. And lastly, once they get permitted, they have to do it. So the county rules says if you have 3 complaints against you once you're permitted, and we send out the development director, the planning and development director, and if she smells it at the next residential property, you are in deep trouble. You got to change your thing, and eventually, if you don't change your system, you can lose your permit. So there's very high stakes for getting odor control right, and these guys are going to have to get odor control right, but we have to finish the permitting process to do that. And that's the irony here, is that people who are against marijuana are talking about they want us to stop giving permits. Well, stop giving permits means we don't have the odor control on them, which is a part of a permit requirement, and we don't have them coming in telling us anything. We can only prosecute people for perjury charges on marijuana. We can't prosecute them for marijuana. It's not a crime anymore. So if people want us to have accountability on these operations, you got to take permits.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, though, which is that cannabis is supposed to bring quite a bit of money into the county as tax revenue. And maybe you can more accurately give me a sense of the numbers, but what I saw, and again, quoted in the LA Times here, was that for the first 3 tax quarters, the county received about $4.6 million, where some consultants thought they would collect something more like $24 million.
The consultants, when they tried to tell us how much revenue we could expect, they said somewhere between $5 and $25 million. And I'm like, wow, we paid you money to tell us that large of a difference. You know, it's coming in at first at the lower end of the projection, but it is within the realm of the projection. We are budgeting well over $5 million a year. What that's meant is that instead of making cuts, 2 years ago, we were looking at making cuts in mental health services. We were looking at making cuts in the sheriff's department. We're not doing that anymore. We're adding positions, making the county more safe, and at the same time, doing a lot more to hold people accountable that aren't playing by the rules in marijuana than we ever have before it was legal.
So if, let's say, the revenue stays at $5 million, and I don't know a lot about the county's budget, but it doesn't strike me as a tremendous amount of money.
It's huge when you just look at the general fund portion of the budget. It will only stay at $5 million if we shut down half of the places in the county, right? I mean, if you do the calculations, and if we do adequate means to make sure people are paying their taxes, then that number will go up considerably.
You have mentioned perhaps fairly that this has taken up a lot of oxygen in the room, and there are a lot of other issues to talk about, yet it seems like it's kind of hanging around, and for some people it's turned into such a big question that you could conceivably see a Democratic challenger now for your next election, and we're seeing some fairly heavy-hitting Democratic donors looking to support other people. Are you concerned for yourself and politically what this could mean in the next year?
I've tried to always make sure that I do the right thing, even if I know there's going to be controversy. And I just think that the easy path would have been to vote for a ban that's illusionary. A bunch of people would have been very happy with that. But there still would have been marijuana being grown. There just would be no tax revenue for it. And there'd be no money to have an enforcement team. And I don't know if you look deeply into this, the black market of marijuana is an enormous vector for human pain. It's the infrastructure in this state for human trafficking. It's the infrastructure for harder drugs. And I think that counties that create these illusionary bans are doing a disservice because they are making the black market survive. And my ultimate goal is knock out the market share of the black market. If people are going to buy marijuana, at least give them an ethical route to do so and one that doesn't trade in human pain.
Supervisor Doss Williams, thanks again for the time today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're tuned to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Up next is a subject that has entered the national discourse more and more recently as women continue to come forward and say it shouldn't be stigmatized. Breastfeeding. Host Brian Reynolds recently sat down with two local authors about their new book on successful breastfeeding. It's titled Suckle, Sleep, and Thrive. Their approach focuses on new parents better understanding their baby's needs via behavioral cues, and the book offers lessons about the issues basic to human life and healthy children.
I'm Andrea Heron, and I'm a lactation consultant, and I have been working in San Luis Obispo as a consultant for over 30 years. My background is I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner, and after finishing graduate school, I decided I wanted to dedicate my life to doing a preventative medicine practice and chose to do breastfeeding. I see probably about 100 patients through my office about a month, and have the privilege of working with all these wonderful young women, fathers, and babies.
Excellent. Lisa?
I'm a journalist. I studied at Cal Poly, went into television, worked at KSBY as a television producer, then did some online investigative reporting, and wear various hats in this community, including the president of the San Luis Obispo Children's Museum, and do freelance journalism.
Excellent. And just out of curiosity, how did you and Andrea hook up?
I met Andrea through one of her support groups. She does weekly breastfeeding support groups where moms come together, ask questions, learn about their baby's development. And I was really struck by the information that she was sharing after all the preparing that I did to have my own baby. I thought, why is this information new and why isn't this common knowledge?
The theme of your book is that young parents, young mothers, get discouraged early in the process. And some of that discouragement is based on misinformation. With something so important to the development of young kids into healthy adults, that bothers me a lot. So broadly speaking, what is the fundamental theme of the book or the takeaway you want to leave your readers with?
Breastfeeding is something that mothers need to learn, and they need to also learn to know their baby, that it takes time. And there are hurdles for all of us in learning something new. And by learning your baby, watching your baby, and giving it time, and with a resource that you can count on and refer to, that you can overcome any hurdles and meet your goal.
We had our babies my oldest son is 40 this week. And we took classes, Lamaze and breathing and different things, but I don't, except for La Leche League, I don't remember ever having a class on breastfeeding techniques or breastfeeding support or, because I know in some cases, no disrespect to La Leche, but sometimes the message can be strident and the mothers get even more discouraged, like, what's wrong with me? But none of the ideas were present or talked about how to look at your baby, how to understand their mannerisms and so forth, because they don't obviously speak. So what gives? Why? I mean, people have been having babies for millions of years. Why is this only coming to now? What have been the barriers in the past?
Well, this information has been around. I actually was trained in infant cues in the 1970s. And it was a satellite course from University of Washington, and it was very exciting information. And it was supposed to be disseminated, but it was missed. It was missed because there's so many rigid rules coming out of the hospital, out of the medical model. Hmm. So taking the time to watch the baby doesn't fit in the medical model. The medical model goes along with rules and regulations and so much time and so many ounces.
Uh-huh.
So that's part of the problem. That's what we're trying to overcome. And even today, it's the same.
In this modern era, why aren't classes like this ubiquitous? Why aren't they offered in tandem with Lamaze and other issues like that?
There are classes, and women are going to their hospitals for meetings prior. What's not happening is the follow-up care and the support from the pediatric side, and primarily doctors aren't educated in breastfeeding. They don't have this in medical school, very little, so they don't feel that they're equipped. There's a lot of apathy on their parts. They're not necessarily getting the correct advice. They're very vulnerable to marketers, to all the free formula that they get in the mail, the free formula they get in the hospital if you're not in a baby-friendly designated facility. So it's a really complex problem, mostly a lot of deficits in the healthcare system, and women also, depending on where they live in the country, those social norms that aren't in favor of breastfeeding are really going to affect them. If you look at a map of breastfeeding prominence in the United States, it looks a lot like an election map. Red states and blue states, high breastfeeding rates along the coast and the whole Central America, the breastfeeding rates are significantly lower. We're seeing that over 80% of babies are put to the breast. In 2015, there were 4 million babies born in the United States. About 4 out of 5 started out breastfeeding. But the bad news is within days, many of these babies are already receiving formula. Only 1 in 4 are meeting the minimum American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation of 6 months of exclusive breastfeeding. And the AAP recommends continued breastfeeding through that first year. So within days or weeks, you know, these women want to breastfeed, but they're already giving formula to their babies because there's these other factors. And a lot of it has to do with their experience, their birth experience, so many interventions. And each intervention can lead to trauma in the mother and the baby, cause difficulties in her hormonal process, maybe some pain in the baby from being wedged in the birth canal too long. And these can cause breastfeeding difficulties that take some time to overcome.
When you say intervention, could you give me an example?
Cesarean. One in 3 women are having cesarean.
Okay.
Each intervention, from inductions to epidurals, they call it a cascade of birth interventions because each intervention leads to the likelihood of the next.
Often with an epidural, it slows down labor, and then the mother has Pitocin to help speed up the labor.
Right.
And then she ends up, it slows down her labor, and often they'll end up with a cesarean.
Yeah.
Or they'll have a mighty vac delivery, so the baby will have a bruised head or even what's called a cephalohematoma, and then the baby has trouble sucking.
What I've heard you say so far is, on one level, there's a lack of information. Doctors aren't trained for postpartum issues so much. And then there's misinformation or disinformation based on, say, religious or social values? Is that correct?
Yeah, the social norms are really not in line to support caregiving for a breastfed baby. You know, parents were told not to spoil their baby. Don't hold your baby too much. But it's really that skin-to-skin time and holding that supports breastfeeding and really supports normal psychological development. So in the past, babies, and it's these misconceptions are still out there, that a baby should be sleeping through the night relatively soon to schedule the baby, schedule the feeds. But we all know that those are things that do a disservice to breastfeeding and a disservice to the infant's health.
If the data are there and the wisdom is there, but the mechanisms in getting the word out are limited, how does one take the trickle and turn it into a, no pun intended, a flow, a deluge of good information for young mothers and young families? What's the mechanism? What's the person? Does it need government funding? How about your ideas on that?
Well, I believe there are systemic changes that are needed. I think since there's such a deficit of knowledge in sort of the from the doctor's perspective, then if they don't have that expertise and it's not happening in medical school and it's not being required for the board certification, then they need to bring in lactation services into their practice. Maybe instead of seeing when they're checked in for a well visit, maybe instead of seeing the physician's assistant to get them organized before the doctor comes in, maybe it's a lactation consultant who gets those 15 minutes. And then maybe those extra 15 minutes while the mom's just waiting until the doctor arrives, maybe that's the window. Maybe that's the opportunity. So these kinds of changes are needed, but there seems to be a lot of kind of controversy and back and forth. I don't know, Andrea, what you're seeing.
Well, it is there at the WIC level, at the low-income level. Mm-hmm. There's a big push for anti-obesity to teach the cues so they don't the babies aren't overfed and they continue breastfeeding. But it's not at the upper-income level.
Wow.
It skipped that. So there's a push. There's a lot of information about cues, but it takes time. So I don't know how you, in the modern medical model, where you're trying to see a patient every 10 minutes because the reimbursement is so low, there isn't any reimbursement for that kind of education.
Wow.
So at the national level, there would have to be an ICD-10 code or
a
billing code to reimburse a doctor to spend 15 minutes talking about cues.
Right.
And that doesn't exist.
So you can't see me, but I'm shaking my head.
I mean, that doesn't exist.
But one thing you have to understand is, I mean, there's some problems within the system. But maximizing breastfeeding rates is a key government strategy to improve public health in the United States. Infants who are breastfed have reduced risk of asthma, obesity, type 2 diabetes, ear and respiratory infections, and a reduced risk of sudden infant death syndrome. And for mothers, breastfeeding can help lower risk of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, ovarian and breast cancer. So these are just a few of the many scientifically proven benefits. The government has objectives. They're wanting to improve things. It's just so hard to change the paradigm of our medical system. And I just want to say, I don't think it's just about mothers and babies. It's about families. Families need help. And it's not just low-income families, middle-class families, upper-class families. And we are, as a nation, we are only as strong as our families. And parents are more isolated than ever before. Families are requiring, in many cases, two jobs, and women are needing to go back to work. And they're facing increased risk of postpartum depression because they have this pressure of going back to work. And they're trying to do it all.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. We were joined today by Andrea Herron, a local lactation consultant for many years, and also journalist Lisa Rizzo. They're both have written a book, recent book called Suckle, Sleep, and Thrive. And it's about producing better results with breastfeeding, stronger babies, stronger families. Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Tyler Pratt here. Contributor Beth Thornton recently met with Central Coast glassmaker Eric Dandurand from Harmony Glassworks. After traveling the world to study glassmaking, Dandurand settled in Harmony, California, where he opened a studio in an old barn. When he's not creating stunning vases and sea creatures, he's teaching the craft to aspiring artists and the public.
We are in a space the size of a barn. In the back is a work area with steel rods, protective glasses, and a furnace that looks to be burning at about 2,000 degrees.
That's correct.
At the front of the building is a store filled with glassworks available for purchase. Eric, when I think of glass blowing, I think of places like Venice, Italy.
Yes, that you could say Murano Glass is world headquarters.
So give us some history about your artistic journey and how you made it to Harmony, California.
I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada. I went to University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm an art major, and I took a minor in Spanish. And so in studying Spanish, I wound up over in the Basque Country of Spain, and I met a lot of Swedes at my school. I am Swedish myself. My grandpa grew up speaking Swedish in America, and so I made friends with a lot of the Swedes. I ended up going to Sweden, and I spent 2 years in Sweden, actually, and I apprenticed at a glass studio there, and also working in Spain in the summers. I came back to America, and I took a journey to several studios from Las Vegas over to Arizona in that direction, and then all the way up to the Canadian border along the coast. And my last stop was Harmony. Carl Radke was the owner at the time. It was Phoenix Studios. Phoenix Studios was here from 86 to 2005. So I came in, I guess this was 97, and I landed an apprenticeship and moved here to the Central Coast. And I apprenticed with Carl for 6 years, and I branched off a couple years and then heard Harmony was available. This was about 2007.
Seems like you were lucky to find somewhere to apprentice here in California.
You can find them, but it's not that easy to land an apprenticeship. You can also go the school route, and you can get all the way up to a PhD in glass studies. I offer apprenticeships. The fellow you saw working here before when I was making the octopus, it was his first day in the studio opening and closing doors, so he's just getting his feet wet.
So there are several different glass making methods, right? And
yeah.
The method that you prefer or that you work in most often is glass blowing, where you're actually blowing through a rod.
Yeah, and even more particular, I'd say it's called furnace glasswork, and that's where we're pulling molten glass onto the end of a pipe. It's also called off-pipe glass blowing. It's more for larger vessels and sculptures. So when I think of glass, I think of four main genres, and that would be the main one that we're known for here in Harmony, the furnace glasswork. We also do torch work, though, which is called lamp working as well. Back in the day, it was done over oil lamps. So that's more of like, you can do smaller sculptures, kind of things you would see at a carnival. And it's what most people's idea of glass blowing is. I think of making little sculptures of animals and that kind of thing. And we do that as well. We take a break on the furnace from time to time, and we'll do torch work. And then another big area of glass work is slumping and fusing. And we call that oven work, where you'll cut pieces like you would in stained glass, and then you'll melt them together, and you can make all kinds of things. The fourth main one I think of is stained glass. We don't really do much stained glass here. I do represent some stained glass artists, but we do all of the other three. We do oven work, torch work, and furnace work, and combinations of them all. Like I make elements in different areas and use them to make different items.
I noticed that some of your pieces have beautiful multicolored flecks, like confetti. There are others that have the iridescent swirls of color.
Yes.
So when you set out to create something, do you have a very specific plan in mind, or is there an element of surprise with each piece?
There's an element for surprise for sure when you're doing it for the first time. So if I have like new colors, new color combinations, or even new shapes, that will produce new results. The iridescent glass it has a lot of silver in it. So, and it tends to be more opaque. So depending on the effect I'm going for, I'll choose how to treat the glass. It is something we are kind of known for here at in Harmony, and it was something Carl Radke was known for with Phoenix Studios. The iridescent glass can be tied back to the Art Nouveau period, the Tiffany Favrille style art glass, and you melt silver in the glass, and then you spray a tin suspended in alcohol on it. The alcohol will evaporate. Tin will combine with the silvers and will luster up to a really shiny iridescent surface.
Do you also have a chemistry background?
No, not really. Just basic. I have taken glass chemistry classes, and I make some of my own colors, but I don't. I'm not a chemist. No.
Aspiring glassblowers can come here and take a class from you, or apprentice, as you mentioned. So how would someone go about making that happen?
It's a one-on-one kind of process. We do offer a lesson for couples as well, and even more. We have three and sometimes even groups of like up to 12. You would come in, and we would talk to you about our equipment and just kind of introduce you to our studio. You start off with a lesson where you make a vase or a bowl, and you can choose a variety of shapes for the bowl, like straight walled or more flared or kind of floppy top, that kind of thing. And then we also offer like a vase, a kind of more like a carafe shape, and you can kind of adjust and play around with the rim of that shape as well. We, I think, offer the most hands-on experience kind of glass blowing introductory lesson you can do in America, I would say. They offer these lessons at like Corning Museum and different studios around the country, and usually it touch it a little bit here and there, but we'll introduce you to all the tools. We'll tell you how those tools work. We'll use those tools to shape it, to open up the rim of the piece, to maybe pull and push it in areas if you're going to get more artistic. We just try to have a lot of fun with the lesson and make you have a nice memory at the same time.
So how long does it take to create a piece like that?
A typical lesson, I'd say, probably takes an hour.
When the hour is up, you don't walk away with a vase in your hand.
Everything we make in the course of a day, we put in the oven. It's an annealing oven. It's still at about 1,000 degrees, and it takes we will take about 12-hour process to cool down everything we make in the day at the same time, and then they'll be ready the next day. Some items take much longer, the thicker the piece. So, for example, I know a fellow who made a 100-pound paperweight for Corning Museum, and it took 3.5 months to cool down the paperweight correctly. They tried it several times, several of them cracked, and they finally got the cycle right.
Do you offer classes to the public year-round?
We do. We offer different types of classes. We offer we are doing furnace glass blowing right now, and we'll be doing it until August 18th. But then August 18th, again, until around Thanksgiving, we'll be offering torch lessons, the bead lessons. Our furnace lessons, for example, are $190 to make a vase or a bowl. There's a lot more overhead to do those, but then we offer the bead lesson for $65.
Tell us a little bit about Harmony.
It's a nice little town. It's about 2 acres, I guess. Population 18. The joke is that's 9 people and 9 cows. We don't really know what the true population is, but it's about that. That's the local residents live up the valley, and one local resident lives right here in town. We have a neat mural that explains the history of Harmony and how it dates back to, well, I guess, late 1800s with the Swiss-Italian ranchers, you know, the Sotos, and they still live here in Harmony Valley as well. There's a pottery, Harmony Pottery, and he's got a lot of great ceramics. On the hill is the Harmony wine cellars, and you can do wine tasting up there. Of course, come and see us at the glass shop too, in the big barn.
That was Eric Dandrand, owner, teacher, and artist at Harmony Glassworks on the Central Coast. I'm Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Thanks for tuning in to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's berry season. Time to put on the elbow-length leather gloves and wade into the brambles, right? Well, not quite. It's easier now to pick berries, and it's family-friendly. Plus, berries are not just for pie anymore. Up next, Father Ian Dellinger goes blueberry hunting, then gets creative in the kitchen in Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm Playing with Food.
I found my thrill.
It's berry season. The rain is gone, the sun is out, the berries are a-poppin'. Time to put on the elbow-length leather gloves and wade into the brambles, right? Not quite. I headed to a berry farm and discovered that berry picking is no longer a semi-lethal pastime. Just south of Buellton, you can pick your own blackberries and blueberries. No pain involved. It's a fun afternoon with the family. But I didn't actually pick any blueberries. I learned about blueberries so I could do some of my own playing with food.
I'm Ed Seaman. I represent Santa Barbara Blueberries and the Wild Farmlands Foundation, all located on Restoration Oaks Ranch. I retired into farming, which you can question me about that later, but before that I was an IT manager and an internet marketing consultant.
The World Wide Web is a lot different than the web of berries.
Yeah, the World Wide Web is inside and virtual. And berries, at least what we do here, natural organic berries are outside and organic.
We're right next to the freeway, right next to 101. You can hear it, you can see it. And we've got all of these plants that I've never seen before, because other than strawberries and brambles, I've never seen berries live.
Interesting. Okay. This is you pick. So when you say brambles, you think thorns and spines and tangled up and everything. Bramble is tangled, right? We have blackberries. And traditional blackberries are brambles. And they grow natively outdoors here. These plants, and look at the thickness of the stem here.
It's like almost as thick as rhubarb.
Yeah. They will grow, a good 8-10 feet tall on these big, huge canes, and they're thornless. You'll take a couple of different varieties or strains of a plant, and you'll splice them together, and then you'll try and grow something that has preferred characteristics. So the preferred characteristic for us on this is two of them. One, they're big, they're thick, they're hardy. Number two, there's no thorns. This is you pick.
No thorns. That's great.
So
okay.
What you see here on these blackberries, they're not going to be due until probably August or September, but the flowers turn into blackberries, which are as thick as my thumb. These are wonderful, big, thick, juicy berries. So this is the new farming, if you will. There's no brambles. and nothing to hurt your kids.
That's great. No more thorny brambles. The kids will be safe. That may be true, but it's still a farm with living things. Ed made an obvious but important point.
When you're growing outdoors, you don't have control of the environment. That's part of the glee, if you will, of growing outdoors. It's like you're dealing with nature and everything that comes with it.
And there are a lot of things that come with it.
We're right on the edge of the wilderness. This ranch is 955 acres. We're sitting on about 20 acres, and the rest of the acreage is grasslands and wild oak wilderness. About this time of year, starlings come migrating in here, and they come in big old flocks. And they're very, very smart. And they will sit in those trees over there, and then will watch us. And when we get to a point where there's a lot of blue amongst the green, those starlings will tell us when it's almost harvest season, because they'll start flocking in passes over the fields to see how good the picking is. And if you don't have the bird netting up, they'll take your fruit. And they'll take all of it. They're good. Here, let me show you something. See these corners here? You got to put the netting up on these posts. So we got these 8 to 12 foot posts everywhere. Put the bird netting on top of it on these wires. The starlings will find their way in. And when people are here, they're gate. So a few starlings will find their way in. They'll pick a berry. They'll come up to the bottom of the post where there's a little hole. And then another starling will get on top on the outside of the netting. And they will hand off the blueberries. And then they'll take that blueberry and they'll head for the trees to feed their kids.
Oh, wow.
So they are not stupid critters. They're very smart critters. They talk. If you listen, there's a lot of bird noise going on. We actually tried all sorts of different technologies to protect our berries from the birds. One of them was a noisemaker, and you amplify the sound of a starling dying, being attacked. You amplify the sound of a peregrine falcon attacking, or a red-tailed hawk, or an owl. I mean, there's all sorts of these sounds. They'll sit on the wire or on the post, and they will watch. George elbows Fred and said, George, nothing's been happening. Let's go eat. So George and Fred jump down. They eat. And everybody else is sitting up there on the wire watching George and Fred eat. And they realize, oh, there's nothing happening to George and Fred. So they flock down and they eat. So about 2 weeks after we try all of these techniques, the flashers, the noises, the kites, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. They last about 2 weeks. Then the birds figure it out. The mechanical netting works much, much better than anything else.
So time to check out the blueberries. We're here at the blueberry plants themselves, and they look exactly like they do in Farmville. Have you ever played Farmville?
Yes.
Anyway, some of them are blue, but not very many of them are blue. So what is blueberry season?
Every year is different. The weather dictates. This year we've had a lot of rain. Without the sun, they'll just sit here. And with the amount of rain and the little amount of sun that we've had this year, it's been a late season. We'll open the first week in June. We've been open as early as April. If the weather gets warm sooner, the berries will pop sooner, and then you have an earlier season. The season for the blueberries lasts from 8 to 10 weeks for what we grow. We have 16 different varieties. And what you'll notice is that you've got the green, the purple, the reddish, and then the blue. And what a season like this year is going to do is you're going to have some fruit that comes in right now, like the blue ones that you see here. And then in a couple of weeks, you'll get another rush. And then in a couple of weeks, you get another rush. And when the people come through and pick the berries, another thing that's really good for you pick growers is that allows the smaller fruit and the flowers, which will become fruit, to get more nutrients. And then they come sooner. So by having people come in and pick some of the ripe fruit when there's still a lot of green fruit actually helps a green fruit ripen.
Do blueberries like the fog? Because you're pretty close to the ocean.
They don't mind the fog, but the fog needs to go away so that the sun comes out for our harvest season. So yes, we like the fog. We prefer it in the springtime to go away with that bright sunlight. That's what gets the berries to ripen. Take a look at the back of your berry here. You've got your blue all the way to the stem.
Okay.
That's a sweet, beautiful berry right there. That one's perfect. If you look at this one and this one, you'll see some various stages here. So it goes from blossom to green to red to purple to blue. See, you got a little bit of red on that.
Mm-hmm.
That one have a little tart to it. Okay. Not quite ripe. Still really good. I mean, I like a little bit of tart in it. But these guys, when you get the blue all the way to the stem, they're perfect.
Okay.
They're beautiful.
What happens to the fruit that never ripens? At corporate farms, they do what's called a cull. At the U-Pick,
we don't have culls per se. Our fruit will just drop. And then we're basically feeding the environment.
But you don't let the birds in.
No, we do not want the birds to have them. That's the thing. Just everybody but the birds, okay? And we'll have deer come trouncing through here. And we have weasels, and we've got lots of ground squirrels. This is another interesting thing. Burrowing owls, which are wonderful, wonderful critters, don't care about the berries. So as long as they don't eat our berries, we love them, right? And of course, coyotes. We've got black bear back there. So we really do see a lot of the wilderness come in here. And they all know when it's blueberry season. Everything just gets more active.
The wildlife know when it's blueberry season, but do they know their types of blueberries? Among the acres of blueberries, it was clear that there were several different types of plants. So you said you have 16 varieties of blueberries. What's the difference between blueberries? Because this type over here, these are all heaving with blueberries. Yeah. It looks like a bush of blueberries, where this is looks like a bush with blueberries.
If you come over here, this is probably a really good example. See, these leaves are a little bit bluer.
And they're pointier.
And there's a lot more berries on this bush, but they're not that big. Mm-hmm. Look at this one, and then back to where we were here. See how these are in a cluster?
Yeah.
And they're much, much bigger fruit when they're full grown. You can tell just immediately by looking at these three plants here, these are different varieties. Mm-hmm. When you order the plants, you have to make a decision. Do you want early or late season berries? Big fruit, but not as much volume? Do you want a lot of fruit, but maybe not as big? You got to make all these decisions. And just like with the blackberries we were talking about earlier, people have been splicing and trying to craft their blueberries for a very long time. So there's lots and lots of variations.
How long does a blueberry bush last?
All of these varieties, all 16 that we're talking about, are southern high bush. They will live for 25 years, and they will grow 12 feet tall if you let them. Now, we don't have very many basketball players come out here and pick, so we don't need them to get that tall, but they will keep growing. They're very hardy, too. This is a good example of a plant that we thought was dead.
Yeah, it looks pretty. It's Brown's Christmas tree.
Yeah, and then we got all that rain this year. It's not dead. It's not going to give us a lot of fruit this year, but next year we're going to prune this. It's going to be a really nice plant. So we go through all the time and we observe, and that's part of farming is observe. Why does that look greener than this over here? Why are we losing plants here but not over there? There's all sorts of variations that you need to look at to determine.
Yeah, they're like three rows that have dying plants, but the three rows are not right next to each other.
Exactly. So that tells us there's something wrong with the valve, or there's something with the drip systems, the emitters are clogged or something like that. Another thing might be just critters. We have gophers. Now, if you have a garden, you probably are familiar with gophers. I guess you can get as many as 66 gophers per acre, and they move a lot. And we think they're cute, they're fun, but they're very destructive. And just like the birds, if you're going to say number one is the birds, number two is the gophers.
Then there's a question that every consumer of local produce has. Is this an organic farm?
Yeah. I'd call it above ground organic. We don't use sprays and pesticides. We're not going to be below ground organic because we use sulfuric acid to acidify the soil. People have come and said, why don't you use something else? Well, it's too expensive. That's the blunt, honest answer.
I can live with that. Soil conditioning is vital to plant growth, from the corporate farms to the backyard gardens to the U-Pick farm. U-Pick. I wondered about that. When I was a kid in Santa Maria, when there were many, many more strawberry fields, we would go out and pick an entire flat of strawberries at the height of the season. But it seems like it would be a chaotic business model.
We're a small farm. We've got right now 14 acres under cultivation. We could go out to 20 if we decide that there's enough water to do that. So we're never going to compete on a cost level with the big farms that can get into distribution at high volume. On the other hand, we're right on the 101. We get 30,000 cars a day come through here during the summertime. Honestly, that's a really good location. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. You get back behind the barn there, you can't hear the freeway, and you're in God's country, right? It's gorgeous. People want to come out here. They want to experience the outdoors. And the blueberries themselves are really, really good the way that we grow them, because we're not trying to do things at a breakneck pace to, you know, to hit the quarterly report. We want these plants to be happy. And so we take a little bit more care and we do a little bit more with them, which would, in the end, imply a better quality fruit. And I think a lot of people will agree that our fruit is just really, really good. Of course, any fruit, whether it's the blueberries, the blackberries, the raspberries, any fruit that you get anywhere on the planet, the closer that you are from picking it to eating it, the better the fruit's going to be, the more nutritional the fruit's going to be. It's just good for you. No sprays, no pesticides. So when people come here, they know exactly what they're getting because they're picking it right off the bush.
So if the model is taste while you pick, I'm ready for tasting. So you're saying this big one that's about almost half an inch wide mm-hmm. is perfect for eating right now?
Yep.
Should I give it a try?
Yeah, go for
okay.
it.
Okay. Mmm.
Is it sweet enough?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's very sweet. You know, it doesn't taste anything like blueberries that you buy in the supermarket. Would you say that's true?
90% of the time, that's true. I'd say that I have gone into supermarkets and gotten a 6-ounce or a 12-ounce package of blueberries that were really good. So I can't say that we're always better than the supermarket. I'm going to give them some credit. But I'd say 90% of the time, you're not going to get as sweet or as good a fruit in the supermarket. It's impossible because you're not getting it right off the bush.
But what I'm noticing is that the skin on these, there's very little pop. Blueberries I've bought in the supermarket, there's quite a bit of pop. The skins are tougher.
Mm-hmm. When you put them in a container and you ship them, there's all sorts of ways to preserve fruit. You know, you want to refrigerate them. That helps cool the fruit down if it's been in the hot sun and they last longer. But these refrigeration trucks, air systems that are way beyond me, that I'm sure that the folks in the global food system use to keep the fruit as long as they can keep it, that probably has more to do with the skin than anything else, what they're using to try and preserve it. I'm not into that technology. I just know it's out there.
I'm sure you have a chest freezer full of berries.
We do.
What is your tip for preserving berries?
If you want to freeze them, don't wash them. That's tip number one. That's a big, big deal. Berries are mostly water. It's not just blueberries, strawberries, blackberries, raspberries. Most berries are mostly water. And when they freeze, they clump together. The ice actually brings them together. When that ice defrosts, you create these icicles, these knives, and that slices the skin, and that's why your fruit is mushy when you thaw it out. So if you're going to freeze the berries, pick them right off the bush, put them in your bag, freeze them. When you defrost them, they'll be in much, much better shape. If you want to really be precise about freezing your blueberries, freeze them individually. Put them on a tray, separate them from one another, freeze the tray, then come out, and then now you've individually frozen your berries. Now, when those berries are thawed out, they're really pristine. They're good.
So whether properly frozen and then thawed or straight off the bush, what can we do with blueberries other than blueberry jam and blueberry pie?
We have a lot of blueberry recipes on santabarbarablueberries.com. And the reason we did that is because people ask that question a lot. My favorite unusual food from blueberries is barbecue sauce. You would not have thought that blueberries would make a good barbecue sauce, but it's really good. All of the desserts and everything that you can do with blueberries, obviously there's a lot of stuff that you can do because it's fruit. We're also doing a lot with blueberry vinegar. You mix it up like apple cider vinegar or any other culinary vinegars, and there's a lot you can do with it. Our farm neighbor has a couple of young men that like to hunt. They got some deer. He asked me about using the blueberry vinegar to soften up his venison, and it was delicious. So for gamey meat, the vinegar actually loosens up and adds a flavor to whatever meat might be tough.
So the vinegar's made with fermented blueberries. It's not blueberry-flavored vinegar.
No. So what you do is you take blueberries, you ferment it, you have a specific acidity level that you're trying to target. You can make blueberry wine, right? It's past the alcohol state. So it takes a little bit longer, but you're literally using nothing but blueberries and water to make the fermented food. Because blueberries are so high in antioxidants and all the other good stuff that comes with the blueberries, the vinegar is good food.
Using blueberry vinegar as a tenderizer gave me a great idea. We use acids to tenderize tough cuts of meat, as Ed described. I discovered that blueberries are less acidic than lemons and limes and more acidic than oranges and tomatoes. They have a very similar pH to apples, pineapples, and grapefruit. So I made a marinade of whole fresh blueberries, habanero chilies, cardamom, and a little cinnamon and some salt and pepper to cover some boneless pork ribs. I marinated the pork ribs for 24 hours, wiped off the marinade, and cooked them on the grill pan. The result was amazing, and my friends Hans and Brenda agreed.
Very nice.
I think it's good. I'm not a big fan of pork often, but this is actually really good.
Yeah, it doesn't taste like what I think with pork, and it's got a nice spice note to it.
Mm-hmm. Does it taste like blueberries?
Not really.
I think there's a slight sweet note, like just a little.
Very slight sweet. Yeah, I think it actually balanced out well with the flavor, too. So, like, the spice was there with a little bit of sweet, so it was nice and even.
Yeah, maybe so. I would not have thought of that. I'm having another piece.
Me too.
So I learned a lot of new things, and I cooked something new by playing with food in my kitchen. Blueberries are just down the road from all of us. Just another great food from right here on the Central Coast. And, of course, I did make blueberry pie.
This little piece of gum is a three-course dinner.
Bull.
No, roast beef, but I haven't got it quite right yet.
I don't care.
I wouldn't do that. I really wouldn't.
So long as it's gum, then that's for me.
Violet, now don't you do anything stupid.
What's it taste like? It's tomato soup.
Hey, second course is coming up. Roast beef and a baked potato. Mmm.
What's for dessert, baby?
Dessert? Here it comes. Blueberry pie and cream. It's the most marvelous blueberry pie I've ever tasted.
Holy Toledo, what's happening to your face?
Cool it, Dad. Let me finish.
Yeah, but your face is turning blue. Violet, you're turning violet, Violet.
What are you talking about?
I told you I hadn't got it quite right yet. Violet, what are you doing now? You're blowing up.
I feel funny.
I'm not surprised.
What's happening?
You're blowing up like a balloon.
Like a blueberry.
It happens every time. They all become blueberry.
But I was much more careful and prepared it the traditional way.
They're really a lot of fun. Everybody loves blueberries. It's very hard to find people that don't. We've actually had moms come in, little Johnny. Johnny doesn't like blueberries. Okay, that's fine. And he comes back, he's got blue on the edges of his mouth. I thought Johnny didn't like blueberries. Well, he likes these blueberries. Okay. So Johnny likes good blueberries. Yes. We feel good about that. You know, we're evangelizing good blueberries, I guess. Yeah, blueberries are like puppies. Everybody loves them.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
In happiness too, like the Oompa Loompa Loompa Dee Doo.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Issues and Ideas will be off next week. In the meantime, you can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.